Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, join us as we explore heart health and homeopathy, a show co-hosted by Homeopathy World Community founder and homeopath Debbie Brook, with Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Let's go.
Hi, this is Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community. This is a really special day, the day after a major election in the United States. We voted in for a second term, Mr. Obama, and we will see how much change occurs. Unfortunately, there was a Proposition 37 in California, which was for the people to vote to label genetically engineered foods. And they decided, the vote was, they did not vote for that in a majority. So that is one sad piece of information, but I'm hoping that we can continue to make strides and efforts to have the right and freedom to see what is in our food and be able to make our choices. Today is November 7th, 2012. Thanks so much for listening to these free informative broadcasts. I so much appreciate having Dr. Adil with us every Wednesday. And for for those people who may be missing it today, we turned the clocks back for Eastern Standard Time in the United States. We are not in daylight savings anymore, and for that reason, it is now 10:30 on the East Coast in America. While what time is it over by you? It's about 9 p.m.?
9 o'clock. 9 p.m.
Yes. Okay. So we have probably a lot of information to cover, as we always do, and people to recognize, the masters who we stand on their shoulders, and I'll let you go ahead and get started.
Yeah, and it's actually a very lovely day, and at the outset, I wish you all the very, very best. Happy birthday and many, many happy returns of the day, and may the Lord bestow His power so that you go strength by strength and hone your abilities and skills so that homeopathy is benefited.
Thank you so much.
Actually,
I appreciate that.
I had some plans in my mind. And as I told you, I had a hunch that your birthday is around. And I was going to ask you that I would open up the show and introduce you rather than you introducing me every time.
Okay.
But that did not happen then.
Well, I didn't really formally introduce you, as I typically do. You know, but if you want to start the show over again, go ahead.
No. I mean, the show has already started. And, it has been an interesting week for U.S. and, of course, many countries around. And congratulations to the new elect, the president, Obama. Hope he serves his presidency well the next coming years. And we have a host of questions. And I would like to discuss about 3 to 4 questions today. One question is from Dr. Agrawal from a place called Palwal in India. And he says, in one of the prominent homeopathic newsletters, it is mentioned that homeopathy can reverse irreversible pathologies. What is your view regarding this statement? Very interesting question, because many homeopaths claim such things. So the words reversible and irreversible need to be seen in reference to context to the pathology what we are discussing about. What seems to be apparently irreversible may be to some extent reversible. But to claim that gross structural changes in terminal cases having secondary symptoms can be reversed back by a dynamic medicines will be stretching things too far. Let me give an example. For example, suppose a patient comes to you and let me give an example of the last case which I had already mentioned. A case, 52 years old female who had come to us for 7 months. She had got fever, low grade fever, excess fatigue. She was diagnosed wrongly to have tuberculosis. She was treated with anti-tuberculosis drugs allopathically, and it had a disastrous effect on her because she reacted adversely. So they had to be stopped. Then she was thought to have rheumatism, and she was started on steroids. She felt slightly better and pepped up, but then she started developing severe anemia and generalized swelling. So again, steroids were stopped. Then on, she was put on vitamins and some minerals. Then she came to us 7 months after. And we took her history, and I asked her what the history was. And she said that 7 months ago, her daughter had committed suicide. 8 months ago. And from then on, she had actually received a shock. Well, after that, she started having these symptoms, and the symptoms continued till she presented to us. I examined her. All her investigations came out to be normal, her blood counts and everything. So again, I had a hunch, seeing many patients I had a hunch that she might be suffering from something related to blood, possibly a malignancy. So we did a bone marrow, and unfortunately, she landed up with acute myeloid leukemia. Well, she was basically very perturbed, hearing that she has cancer. And since I had diagnosed the case, she said that she would be open only to homeopathy, and she would not take any allopathic medications. She was in crisis state. I mean, when she was diagnosed, she was not too good. Her hemoglobin had dropped down to 3 g/cent, which is quite low. We infused her with 5 units of blood. So she came back to, say, hemoglobin of 8 to 8.5. Still very weak. And the first medicine we started was natrum uraticum directly. And ascending potency every single day for 5 days. I increased the potency starting from natrum uraticum 30 to 200, 1 m, 10 m, 50 m. This is called as Kent's octave scale. In such cases, when you want a bit faster result, you choose a remedy and increase it in ascending potency. And you'll not believe, by 1 week or so, the counts had improved drastically. And yes, she did have acute myeloid leukemia, but the crisis phase was tackled by a drug called natrum uraticum. Not only the symptoms, but the pathology also. So, such cases where you have got good amount of physical generals, good amount of symptoms, so irrespective of the diagnosis, irrespective of the pathology being grave, it was possible to reverse this crisis. I don't say the patient has been cured, but yes, we could do substantially well in the given time. She's still under treatment. She's gone back to her house. And she's continuing with the next drug given to her is China, because natrum uraticum is now, this is over. The drug natrum uraticum was given because of the grief, the profound grief that has led to this malignant state. In the entire family history, right from great-grandfather to grandfather to her parents, none of them have got malignancy. The uncles, the aunts, no one has got malignancy in any form. This was quite new. So, second case, for example, a case which I saw today itself. Now, she's a known case coming to me since past 1 year. She's a case, a 37 years old girl, married, having one child. She had a late conception last year, and during pregnancy, she started developing in the fourth month of intrauterine life, she started developing extreme breathlessness. So her gynec examined her and she could find some murmurs. So she did an echocardiogram. She was sent for an echocardiogram, the lady, and ultimately the lady was diagnosed to have atrial septal defect. That is, the septum between the two atria, there was a hole in that. And for all those 36 years of her life, this lady was quite unaware. Only during pregnancy, fourth month of pregnancy, she could feel the symptoms. Then, the cardiologists were debating whether to operate or whether to continue the pregnancy, whether to carry out an abortion or miscarriage. Ultimately, somehow, they came to me. And at that time, the only symptom was dyspnea. And we chose the drug Lobelia because she had a characteristic symptom that although she was breathless, but she was better when she was walking fast. By fast walking. So this is a very peculiar symptom which is there in Lobelia, which we will be discussing, obviously, when we go on to the rubric, what we are discussing about chest, that is emphysema. So with Lobelia, we could carry on. We had a big problem during the eighth month of intrauterine life, but luckily she delivered the child well. So this was atrial septal defect. And since one year she is there with me, no problems, absolutely no problems, and she's doing quite well. The hole is as it is, so we cannot cure. So we cannot reverse this pathology. The atrial septal defect is still there, the same sizes, but the patient is very well, no problems in the day-to-day life routines, no symptoms also. So we can't claim, homeopaths should not claim, rather no medicine man should claim that gross structural changes can, in terminal cases, can be reversed with the remedies, especially the dynamic medicines. Such tall claims should be avoided. Hence, every homeopathic practitioner needs to have adequate knowledge of pathology and other basic sciences before they claim such absurdities. So I believe, Dr. Agarwal, that I've answered this question.
Thank you. So what we say is we don't give up hope, and we know that we see gross pathology, and yet there are things that we can use homeopathically and otherwise to provide comfort, to provide palliation, or even to provide improvement so that they can live a normal life.
Yeah, we can try, we can attempt, like any other physician of any other school of thought, we can attempt to improve the life. If possible, we can try to palliate, and if further possible, if we can try to cure, but not all cases.
Right. So we go case by case.
Yeah, it is strictly individualistic. So we cannot generalize, we cannot have statistics that we have cured so many cases and all. As far as homeopaths are concerned, this is not the trend. It may be true for allopaths because they consider only disease-wise or symptom-wise statistics. And for them, cure is only palliation. What we call palliation, they call as cure. So symptom-wise, if the symptom goes away or the disease is abated, then they term as cure. But for us, the terminology of cure carries a greater connotation and a greater amount of significance. So we would not claim such things unless we have given enough times, unless a patient has undergone the entire process of cure, that is Herring's laws of cure, what we call. So we need to see that. And then only we can claim that cure is possible or cure has been done. Otherwise not.
So we take into account much more than just a physical change. We're looking at other values, mental stability without being on drugs, I guess.
Hahnemann himself has said, in aphorism number 76, Hahnemann clearly and explicitly states that only for the natural cases has the beneficent deity granted us in homeopathy the means to cure. These are his words. So, natural cases, we have to identify natural cases. The natural cases are those cases which are untarnished by allopathic or any other modes of suppression. any other modes of treatment. Second, lots of symptoms are available, the original symptoms of the disease and the patient. Mental generals, physical generals are available, and we have drugs to prescribe upon. So in such cases, these cases are called as natural cases. And when we get natural cases, only such cases we can attempt to cure them. Suppose if a case comes to you, for example, a case has taken paracetamol for a headache. A lady, 16 years girl who has a headache, and she has taken paracetamol. And because of the paracetamol, she has got a reaction, skin reaction. And she lands up in Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Stevens-Johnson syndrome means excessive drug reaction, wherein you can get multi-organ failure. A case which I just saw last week, and unfortunately we could not save her. So in such cases, this is called a drug disease or drug miasm. And in such cases, it's very difficult to cure patients. And the patients, sometimes it's fatal. So we have to go.
I think I just heard on the news that second to, I don't know whether it was heart disease or something, iatrogenic disease and death is number two. It's the highest cause of death is by drugs.
Yeah, although it's underreported. See, it's underreported. Many pharma companies would not report it because it gives a bad name to the entire pathy. It creates a scenario of panic or a scenario of scaredness among the population. So you underreport such deaths or you underreport such drug reactions. But nonetheless, we know in daily life, we know people who practice that iatrogenic diseases are number one. And when I deliver lectures, the other day I was delivering, we have a program from the National Academy of Homeopathy, which is called as Homeopathy at the Doorstep. So in that program, every week or every two weeks, we go to some school, some colleges, some gathering where few people are collected, 25, 30, 50 people, and tell them about what is homeopathy, what you should expect, how you should report to the patient, doctor. Because all the patients who come to us, they are allopathic mindset. They carry an allopathic mindset. So they only report to us symptoms. They would not report symptoms. They would not report the sensations. They would not report their dreams and many other things. They think that it's not required. I mean, the doctor would laugh if I tell the doctor that I have a recurrent dream as of flying on air. And for a homeopath, right, this entire dream can give a medication like Sticta Pulmone for sinusitis. So, if we make our patients aware that they need to report such things, they need to give their history in such things, so they would give a better history. Rather, they would not focus completely on pathological diagnoses like hypercholesterolemia or heart disease. They would actually tell us the symptoms they are suffering from heart disease, whether the pain is on the right side or the left side, whether it is radiating to the jaw or whether it is radiating to the back. For this, for an allopath, this hardly matters. The only thing what matters is a change in ECG pattern or a change in echocardiogram. But for a homeopath, changes on those investigations plus the symptomatology matters most. So we have to see all these things and then report.
Thank you. Yes, because it is true that we need to rewire our brain. We need to think in a different way about our own being, our body, how we are in relationships, and report things like dreams and fears and specific symptoms, generals and modalities. Obviously, it would not mean anything to your regular physician. Only homeopaths have something to do with this. So did you have more questions that people were calling in?
Yeah, the second question is asked by one Dr. Shoaib Shah from Lahore, Pakistan. Well, and he says, can a person with a past history of hepatitis A donate blood? I repeat, can a person with a past history of hepatitis A donate blood? This question is asked by Dr. Shoaib Shah from Lahore, Pakistan. Well, I very frequently I get questions on hepatitis, and I think homeopaths are fascinated by hepatitis.
Why is that?
I don't know. Many people ask me about hepatitis.
Is it prevalent?
Yeah, it is quite prevalent in North India. We have got lots and lots of cases of hepatitis. All the five types, A, B, C, D, E, and G. So, lots of hepatitis cases, day in and day out. We are especially in the prevalence. I mean, he belongs to Lahore, Pakistan. Lahore lies in the Punjab state of Pakistan. And even in India, Punjab, similar states, Punjab. Both the Punjabs in Pakistan and India, we have got lots of hepatitis cases. So, he's not wrong in asking about this. But hepatitis B and C and D are much prevalent there rather than hepatitis A. Hepatitis A is a disease, is a viral disease which is transmitted more by food and water intake. Contaminated food and contaminated water transmits hepatitis A, whereas B, C, and D are transmitted by blood donation or by sexual contact or by contaminated dialysis. So fluid exchange should be there. His question is regarding hepatitis A and blood donation. So, well, Dr. Shoaib, a person's suitability to donate blood depends on two general considerations. Whenever as a blood bank person who is taking your blood, I would see two things. That the donation should not be injurious to the donor, and the donated blood will not be unnecessarily hazardous to the recipient. So, both the donor as well as the recipient should not suffer from blood donation per se. Regulations enforced by health agencies in India or even in your country or any other country, they require that as a part of the suitability criteria, a donor should be free from any disease that is transmissible by blood transfusion, insofar as that can be determined by health, history and medical examination as well as investigations. So, there are so many diseases which can be directly transmitted by blood, hepatitis being one of them. In case of hepatitis A, if it's in the active stage, for example, in the first 3 months, it may be transmitted via blood. But if one has had the infection years ago, for example, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, then to my mind, there is not a problem in donating blood. In India, we have got this problem. Many patients, many donors who come for donating blood, they have already suffered from hepatitis A in the past, and they donate blood, and the blood donated by them is infused in the recipients with no problems, absolutely. Then we shift on to the next question, should we?
Just a moment. I see we have a caller. I just noticed that I was... Hello, we have a caller. Yes, is there someone on the line?
And what does he or she wants to say?
Are you able to hear us? I just noticed that you were waiting. Are you just listening in, or are you calling in for a question or comment? Turn up your sound a little bit, please. I'm sorry, I didn't know how long you were waiting to get on the line. Well, okay, so when you're ready, you can send us your message. Okay. All right. Go. I guess they have their browser on and they've got an echo. But otherwise, go ahead, Dr. Adela. I'm sorry that we paused. Okay.
The next question is quite interesting. And this is from Dr. Sumit Chatterjee from Kolkata. Formerly pronounced as Calcutta, but now it is written also by, starts with K, Kolkata. And Dr. Sumit says, in Allen's keynote, in the chapter of Lachesis, it is written, epilepsy from jealousy. Kindly explain by giving examples. Very good question he is asked. I know it is written epilepsy from jealousy. Well, Dr. Sumit, Lachesis is the only drug for the above mentioned symptom. As an example, I'll quote a recent case that is under my care. Rather, not my care directly, but my father's care. The patient is a 4-year-old girl who has got grand mal epilepsy since a year. And it started a month after the birth of her brother. She has responded very well to Lachesis. So apart from few other symptoms, the selection of remedy was based on taking the rubric ailment from jealousy. And now that jealousy was from her brother. That is called sibling rivalry. Sibling rivalry is very prominent in school-going children or toddlers. And if the baby starts getting epileptic convulsions, then for an allopath, he or she would laugh at this symptom. How can a sibling rivalry cause a disease like epilepsy? But as homeopaths, we should respect this. It's a very, very important thing, because otherwise we would lose the wonderful remedies like laxatives if you don't respect sibling rivalry, if you don't respect ailments from jealousy, even at this age. The next question is, can I go on?
Hello.
Debbie, are you there?
I'm sorry. I was talking to the person who was waiting on the line, and she is with us. Please state your name and ask your question. Caller. Caller from area code 718. She was speaking to me a moment ago. And this is a lay homeopath. I'm not sure where she's calling in from. Hello?
But what does she need to know?
I don't know. She started to speak to me, and now she's stopped. Whenever she can, just chime in and ask your question. She had a question, something about a rubric. So when we get to that section, maybe she'll talk.
Okay maybe.
All right.
So, should I go on?
Please,
were you clear
do.
About... Laxatives and epilepsy from jealousy?
I was speaking to her, so I missed what you said. If you wish.
Well, I'll repeat it again. And the question was from Dr. Sumit Chatterjee from Kolkata. And he says, in Alan's keynotes, in the chapter of laxatives, it is written, epilepsy from jealousy. Kindly explain by giving examples. So, as I already said, that laxatives is the only drug for this above mentioned symptom. As an example, we have a case that is under the care of my father, and the patient is a 4 years old girl who has been diagnosed with grand mal epilepsy since past 1 year, and it started a month after the birth of her brother. She has responded very well to laxatives. Apart from few other symptoms, the selection of the remedy was based on taking the rubric ailment from jealousy, that is called sibling rivalry. And I was just saying that sibling rivalry is very common amongst toddlers, school-going children, even adults. So sibling rivalry, and if it there's a clear indication that after the birth of the brother, the epilepsy, the entire syndrome has started, then we should respect the symptom and should not lose wonderful remedies like laxatives. For allopaths or for physicians, they would laugh at this symptom that an event so small as sibling rivalry can instigate the entire process of epilepsy. But then as for homeopaths, if we have to select such drugs, if we have to select, treat the patient, then yes, a wonderful remedy like laxatives can be given only on basis of epilepsy from jealousy. So I believe, Dr. Sumit, that you do have such cases in routine life, provided you take symptoms and respect them.
Right. Well, I understand sibling rivalry can cause a lot of emotional upset, and you can see the pattern in the family. The dynamics can be quite with a lot of conflict. So the fact that it can turn into a pathology is quite fascinating, although we do know that the mind and body are completely connected.
Yeah, but epilepsy has got no pathology. See, when you do all the investigations in epilepsy are negative.
I see.
You do a CT scan, it's negative. I'm talking about epilepsy per se, not secondary epilepsy, not epilepsy after a tumor or after an SOL. But primary epilepsy is it's like allergies. You don't know the cause. It occurs suddenly. You can never predict. The only thing the patient has is an aura. But for homeopaths, and in allopathy, the only thing which we are doing is only controlling convulsions. That's it. What else are we doing? But for homeopaths, if we get such symptoms, if we are very sure of the symptoms like ailments from jealousy, like sibling rivalry or any other thing, then we can really base and we can actually cure or at least curtail the period of epilepsy. Normally, it is said that epilepsy continues for a period of 3 or more years. and would, the people.
Okay, so would you say that using the Lachesis might just be a temporary use?
No,
for...
No way. This for this girl, which I've just given an example, that four-year-old girl with grandmal epilepsy developing after a month after the birth of her brother, without any history of injury. See, we have specifically asked about history of injury, any other form, but the only thing we got in this case was the birth of her brother.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I see.
The behavior which she has shown with her brother, although she is only 4 years old, apart from epilepsy, is she's clearly signaled the parents that I am not liked.
Yes.
You get such cases day in and day out. So as homeopaths, it's imperative that we ask the parents, ask the patients, if they have actually suffered from such a symptomatology. I'll give you another very, very good example. And again, the case is Lachesis. This case I've got, the patient is following. And today morning, in fact, he has come to me. And this is a case of a 62-year-old gentleman. And he came to me around three or four years ago, I'm not sure about that. But when he had come to me, he was discharged from the hospital and after suffering a massive heart attack. And he was asked to undergo, and he did an angiogram. He had a double vessel disease, that is, two vessels were blocked. And he was asked to undergo an immediate angioplasty or at least a bypass, but he refused. He had just retired from service. So he had heard about me through his friends, and he wanted to take homeopathy. For the first time in his life, he had entered a homeopath's chamber. Well, after the history, he was totally focused on... he is a very lean, thin person. His cholesterol levels, his lipid profile is really normal. Not at that time also, and I'm talking about 3 years ago when he had first come to me. No haywire cholesterol and all. Perfectly normal. He has got no addictions, no non-alcoholic, no smoking, a very good disciplined lifestyle, and I was wondering why he got a heart attack. Well, he did not tell me anything about that, and he is still a known case of cancer of the rectum. He developed cancer of the rectum way back in 1992. It was operated, and since then he is perfectly normal. So, well, anyway, the first time he came, I gave him placebo and let him go. I asked him to continue with the allopathic drugs since he was immediately discharged from the hospital, and straight away he had come to my chamber. After 15 days, again I called him, and again I tried to probe into his heart. Why did he bring heart attack? The question I asked him is, why did you bring the heart attack? And he was totally fumbled. He said, people don't bring heart attacks, they just come. I said, no, you bring heart attacks, we bring heart attacks, we bring cancer. So he could not get me for the first time. Second time also he could not get me. Then I thought possibly I am a bit younger to ask such questions. So I asked my father that he should go into his, he should take a history independently. So my father started taking the history, and during the history, it came to his father, the patient's father. And the moment the patient's father's, the chapter of his father came, he was wild. We had not expected such a reaction. And he said, if you ask me anything about my dad, I will leave your treatment and go away and never come back to homeopathy again. And we were perturbed. We said that what has happened, what did we ask wrong? What was wrong in asking you? He said, don't ask me anything about my father. No one has ever asked me anything about my father. Well, so we stopped at that time, called him again. And he was not ready to bring his wife, he was not ready to bring anyone from his family so we could know something about his father. Finally, in the fourth interview, he started crying. And that time, he said that my father left me and my mom very early, that is when I was only 3 years old. So I said, fine, then what happened? Your mother raised you? He said, yeah, my mother has raised me and she's like a god to me, and she died. So I'm happily married, I earn very well, I'm retired. I said, then why did you bring the heart attack? Why did you bring the cancer and why did you bring the heart attack?
Yep.
So, in 1992, he told me an incident. And that was,
that his father had left him some land. And during the court proceedings, the land, when the question of inheritance came, his father had married second time and he had got children from a second marriage. And when the land issue came up in the court, this gentleman was summoned. And that was the time he had completely forgotten about his father. But then the entire scenario came in front of him and he, within a month of court's notice, developed cancer of the rectum. So, anyway, he got his share of land. Ultimately, he refused it and that issue was over. But that instance, he got malignancy of the rectum. He had to suffer for a full 3 years. It got operated and the issue was resolved. I said, then what happened now? Why did you get a heart attack, 3 years ago, before coming to me? He said, something similar happened. I'm not going to reiterate the entire symptom. That's what his patient was. Because the moment I start thinking about my father, I'll get a heart attack. I said, what feeling do you have? It's a feeling of jealousy. I said, why are you jealous of your father? The fact he said was that my grandparents, my grandfather and my grandmother, brought him up so well, showered all their love on my father, and he could not do for me. And I'm extremely jealous, and I cannot tolerate his name. So he writes his mother's name. See, normally I would write Adil Qasim Chimthanawala. Qasim is my father's name. Normally we write in India. But he writes his name, his mother's name in the center, and his mother's surname.
He has totally erased the father's name.
Yeah, but whenever the topic of father comes, he brings out certain malignancies, certain pathologies. First this was cancer of the rectum, now was a heart attack. Now since past 3 years, with Lachesis, of course, Lachesis was the first. Before Lachesis, we gave him apis. Because apart from jealousy, he also has had hatresy. And the most important drug in the entire Materia Medica for hatresy and jealousy is Apis, Apis mellifica. So after Apis, he completely settled down and then he was given Lachesis, and for the past 3 years, only a single dose of Lachesis has been given to him. And I can tell you, he's off all drugs. And in these 3 years, he has built an entire house. He was initially living in a rented place. He has married his daughters. His two daughters got married and he has given all the money. And now, today morning, he's going to Mumbai and for his daughter's delivery. The daughter has delivered a child, so he's gone there. I'm so happy. So this is a very, very important symptom you get.
Thank you very much. We can see the incredible way that our mental and emotional symptoms, or the way that we think about others and ourselves, can influence the outcome of physical pathology and what happens to our body. That's really totally amazing. We do still have a caller. And is it Helen? Is that your name?
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Come on down.
Yeah, clearly.
Turn off the sound on your browser.
Yes, I did. Okay, because the last time I tried to talk to you and you couldn't hear me at all. Okay, I wanted to ask about the chest rubrics. There doesn't seem to be any rubric in my repertory, the synthetic repertory, that deals with fungal infections under the breasts. And the entire issue of breast cancer seems to be very ambiguous in the chest rubrics. So I wish you would discuss that, because breast cancer isn't always detected by symptomology. It's only detected by tests. So I'm not sure obviously you have to use rubrics from every other part of the person's constitution, but it seems that there's some confusion about that. So I wish you'd speak about it, please.
Are you having the Ken's repertory?
Excuse me?
With you as of now?
Do you have Ken's repertory? That's the one that we're
Yes,
using.
I have Ken's repertory. And
please
have
please refer
repertory.
To page 824. 824.
Page 824.
Page 824.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Cancer Mammy.
Uh-huh. It's
on the left hand side if you do have your book. It's under chest mammy. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I was talking also about the other possibly concomitant symptom of fungal infections under the breast. So I know about the cancer mammy rubric, but
how
to select trying
to
differentiate.
Exactly. Actually, when we had discussed this cancer mammy, we had discussed about this rubric. But if you still want, why don't we do it? Next time, we'll talk exclusively about cancer of the mammy.
Oh, that would be wonderful. And all the concomitant rubrics that are relevant to deciding
the relevant drugs and how to differentiate drugs in different stages of cancer mammy and the potencies to be used and repetitions. Everything about cancer of the mammy. Okay?
Wonderful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Thank you so much for calling in and listening to our show. You can listen to the archives anytime, and we did discuss it previously, so go back and learn a little, and then we're going to go into depth on the next one. Okay, Dr. Otto, did you have more questions, or did you want to talk about...
I do have more questions, but I'm not going to go in them, because actually for the past two shows, I've been missing a very important question because she keeps on calling me. It's from Kavita Kuknur from Michigan, USA. And she says, some insights on single-sided edematic conditions. Example, only left ankle edema, etc. And the possible remedies that can be considered. They can be lymphatic or venous congestion states, but still would like to learn more from him. That is from me. Well, Kavita, I would definitely answer this at length. In the next show, but now because it's for 45 minutes, we have not even paid our homage to three important people: Dr. Franz Karl, Dr. Eugene, and just a minute, Dr. Karl Franz. Sorry, we wanted to start the show, but then right away we started. Discussing about those questions. So, great homeopath Dr. Karl Franz was a right hand of Hahnemann, and he died on 8th of November 1835. So, we pay our tributes. Of course, I was going to tell you more about this gentleman, but because of lack of time, we would not go into the details of his life history. So, also with Dr. Eugene Nash, a wonderful homeopath, born and brought up at New York. He graduated and he has written a wonderful book called as Leaders in Homeopathic Therapeutics. It's a brief book on Materia Medica. And upon the fourth edition of 1913, he wrote that Leaders in Homeopathic Therapeutics to my good wife. He has dedicated this book to his good wife, who has done the clerical work under my dictation. This on account of my blindness, as I draw near the end of my earthly career, I hope to leave an influence for good that will live for many years. Yes, Dr. Nash, your book is a wonderful treatise. It has served its purpose all these years and for many more generations to come. The Nash's trios are excellent ways to remember certain drugs in Veterinary Medica. For example, the Nash trio on pain, aconite and chamomilla and coffea. Wonderful drugs. Nash's trio on edema. We have got Kalikab, Phosphorus, and Apis. So there are loads of trios of Nash, and they enthrall generations of generations and make Materia Medica reading more easier. With this, I shift on to our discussion for today, and that is emphysema. Should I?
Go ahead. Yes, we'd love to listen to you speaking.
Yeah. So, see, emphysema, basically, when you think about emphysema, it's a long-term progressive disease of the lungs. It's not a disease, it takes years and years to develop this disease. It primarily causes shortness of breath. You can have a specific rubric. The primary symptom of shortness of breath of emphysema is page number 769. You can see on page number 769, respiration emphysema in, the only drug given is Amoncarb, single mark remedy, respiration emphysema in. Then there's something called a subcutaneous emphysema. Sub means below and cutaneous means skin. So subcutaneous emphysema is a state when air is present in the subcutaneous layer of the skin. There is no rubric in the entire repertory with, wherein we have got the subcutaneous emphysema. It's a deadly condition because in cases of gangrene of the skin or in cases of trauma, of course, we don't get such trauma in times of war. Soldiers used to get bullet wounds and they used to suffer from a bacterial infection called Clostridium welschii. This Clostridium welschii and Clostridium tetani. For Clostridium tetani, which causes tetanus, you have got tetanus shots. But for Clostridium welschii, which causes necrosis and gangrene, it's a very bad disease. We do hardly get such cases. And in that case, in such a infection, you get subcutaneous emphysema. When you touch the skin, the subcutaneous emphysema and the skin, then you can get crepitations or bubbling sounds. You can feel the bubbling sounds. It's a bad omen for that patient. Anyway, but then we have got no rubric for subcutaneous emphysema. Let us concentrate on emphysema of the lungs. So in people with emphysema, see, emphysema basically is not a clinical diagnosis. It's a pathological diagnosis. The tissues necessary to support the physical shape and the function of the lungs, they are destroyed. So which are the tissues? It is the fibrous tissue. The basic lung substance is destroyed. So essentially, when you actually diagnose emphysema, your destruction has already taken place and it is actually another name of lung destruction or destroyed lung. The architecture of the lung is destroyed. Either the part of the lung is destroyed or the complete lung or the lobe of the lung is destroyed, whatever. And it's actually an emphysema is a end result of a disease called as chronic obstructive airway disease or a chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. It's a long time, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, you are continuously having bronchitis. Every winter, you keep on coughing, you have breathlessness, and you take out sputum, you don't take out sputum, you may have fever, you may not have fever, but for years together, you have been treating yourself partially, not completely getting cured. Year after year, you keep on suffering from such symptoms of breathlessness and cough, and eventually, you land up with a disease called as emphysema. So, emphysema is an obstructive lung disease because of destruction of alveoli. Alveoli is the basic unit of the lung. And if that is destroyed, then the lung, the air does not go inside the lung properly. The lung is not oxygenated and there is a dead space created. So, anatomically, you may see the lung, but in fact, the lung, the air has not been exchanged. So, there is no exchange of oxygen and you have a dead space. This is called as emphysema. In some people, there is a deficiency of an enzyme which is called as alpha 1 antitrypsin. This enzyme, alpha 1 antitrypsin, this is responsible for the integrity of the architecture of the wall of the alveoli. So, in such some people who are born with alpha 1 antitrypsin deficiency, they are liable to undergo early emphysematous changes. And in them, if you do a CT scan, if you do an X-ray of the chest, but more than X-ray of the chest, a CT scan is required, you will find the small airways are collapsed and the lung has thinned out. So even you can have a the shadow of the heart is tubular in shape. Normally, you should have a good shadow of the heart, the normal shadow of the heart, and the lungs you can see properly. But in emphysematous heart, the heart becomes tubular. Emphysematous X-ray, you can have a tubular-shaped heart. It's a very characteristic finding on the X-ray of the chest. Then, in some cases, you can have emphysema because of excessive tobacco smoking. If the tobacco smoking also causes chronic obstructive airway disease, it can also cause alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. It can also cause
emphysema per se. So it's one of the commonest causes of emphysema in the world.
Does this include every type of tobacco? Does this include cigars or chewing or what?
No, it includes inhaling tobacco, snuff. It includes cigars. It includes cigarettes of all types. In those susceptible to cigars and snuff, emphysematous changes can be seen as early as 3 years or 4 years of smoking.
Okay.
So when you start getting, and then there's certain diseases like scleroderma. Scleroderma, sclera means the outer, the derma means skin, and sclerosis means thickening of the entire skin, so much so that the skin starts sticking to your body. And in such this situation, the internal organs also undergo certain changes, and the lungs would undergo emphysematous changes. We have got several cases under our care with such. So in rheumatoid arthritis, in autoimmune disorders, you can have emphysematous changes as well. So these are the few reasons why you can develop emphysema. But let me tell you, once emphysema is diagnosed, then it cannot be cured. I repeat, it cannot be cured. It can only be palliated. The symptoms can be abated for some time, but cure is not possible. It's a grave pathological change. Having said that,
this kind of answers how you opened the show today.
Yeah. Well, having said that, loads of people, many, many chronic asthmatics, many, many COPD patients eventually land up with emphysema. But with homeopathy, we have got now so many cases, although not studies proper, but so many cases that drugs like amoncarb, wherein the patient would typically complain of a dry cough, especially at 3 o'clock, either 3 a.m. or 3 p.m. The patient goes to the bed, lies, and moment wakes up with a bout of cough at 3 a.m., keeps on coughing till 1 hour or so. Along with coughing, you can have a sensation of oppression in the chest, breathing difficulty, and then it's the time to give amoncarb. Symptomatic prescription, of course. One of the wonderful remedies which is also cited here is antimony ars. Antimony group of drugs, both antimony ars and antimony tart, are the first line treatment for symptomatic relief of emphysema, especially in bouts. Suppose emphysema, the symptomatology increases in certain climates, for example, very cold climate, either cold dry climate or cold wet climate. Both of these situations, if it's a cold dry climate, then we have got antimony ars, wherein the person would eventually, main complaint of the antimony ars person would be breathlessness, excessive breathlessness and less cough. And the patient would typically say, "Doc, moment I have full meals, if my stomach is full, I cannot walk, I have to sit down, I have to lie down, and moment I lie down, I start coughing. So I can't lie down also, so I have to only sit down. I can only sit down. Moment I try to walk, I get breathless. If I lie down, I get cough." If this is the problem, then the drug is antimony ars. Antimony ars, when the patient has coughs, he or she takes out phlegm, takes out mucus secretion, and the mucus is white in color. Whereas in antimtart, the patient wants to take out mucus, but the patient cannot take out mucus, and he says, "Doc, give me a remedy wherein I can take out. I feel something congested in my chest. The mucus is there in the chest, but it's waiting to come out, but it can't come out. It can't. So there is rattling in the chest. You can hear the rattle, but there is little expectoration. There is breathlessness. There is dyspnea, but it is better by sitting up." So if the patient characteristically says, "Doc, give me a drug, give me an expectorant, then I will feel better," your drug is antimtart. But already if the patient has got excessive mucus secretion, is white in color, it is stringy, then along with dyspnea and cough, aggravated by eating and aggravated by lying down, the drug is antimony ars. Suppose if the patient, emphysematous patient, says, Doc, I've got terrible cough. But the cough becomes troublesome when I walk. And he points to you in the throat pit, on throat pit, near the throat pit. This is the place, Doc, from where the cough originates. And the patient can feel. And the cough is basically very loose. It has some amount of phlegm. The phlegm is slightly yellowish white in color. Then the drug is Heparsulf.
Yellow and white?
Yellowish white. Yellow and white. Not totally yellow. Not deep yellow as in pulsatilla or Kali Sulf, but yellowish white.
And what is
but
this drug?
No problem. Heparsulf has to be given when there is more cough and very less of breathlessness. Breathlessness is not so much predominant. You can have slight feverish feeling. Not fever proper, but feverish feeling. Then you can have a patient who is complaining, who has been suffering from emphysema for years together. 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. He or she is on inhaler and says, Doc, moment I inhale the allopathic drug, I feel better. I feel better for some time. Salbutamol inhalation or steroid inhalation, I feel better. But then again, moment I stop for some days, or if I change places, if I go to the mountains, if I go out, whether it's cold, I get bouts of cough and then breathlessness returns. And if the patient says, Doc, whatever I eat, if I haven't had an ice cream or something cold, even an apple kept in the fridge, refrigerator, and if I eat it directly, my windpipe is very susceptible. I get a perfectly dry cough, and along with dry cough, I get suffocative attacks. If this is the constant complaint, my voice does not change, but the suffocation is predominant. My breathlessness is not predominant, but cough is dry, my suffocation is predominant, and breathlessness, if at all it is there, prevents me from falling asleep. This symptom is there only in two drugs. One is Lachesis, another is Grandelia. So Lachesis is the drug for emphysema.
What is the difference between feeling suffocation and breathlessness? What is the difference?
Breathlessness, the patient has to exert pressure while inspiring or expiring. Expiration is basically an involuntary process because you have inspired, the muscles would automatically relax, contract the internal the chest muscles, and the air would go out. So you don't have to actually throw out air. Even inspiration should not be an exercise. It should be a normal rhythm. But if I have to exercise, you have to forcibly take in the air. That is called as dyspnea or breathlessness. Respiration difficult. The rubric is respiration difficult. I should not have to exert to take in air or give out air. Whereas suffocation is a continuous feeling. Suffocation is a feeling that means something is irritating in my throat. So I am getting a choking feeling. I want to take in air, but the air pipe, is not letting air go inside. So that is a feeling of suffocation. The patient, that is what I would call as choking. Choking is a feeling in suffocation, whereas breathlessness is actually a symptom you can see. And for breathlessness, you can see the patient making efforts. So that is Lachesis.
Thank you.
A wonderful remedy for senile emphysema. That means a person who has reached 40 years, 50 years of his life, and is suffering from asthma, or for that matter, bronchitis, since a long time, 30, 40 years. And after reaching 65, 70 years, any sort of exercises, slight movement, would cause dyspnea, breathlessness. But having said that, if the patient then keeps on walking, then the breathlessness is relieved. So at the first step, moment the patient comes out of the bed, he starts having dyspnea by initial few steps. But then once he starts walking over a period of time, and that rapid walking, the dyspnea decreases. This is a characteristic rubric, the symptom of a drug called Lobelia inflata. And Lobelia inflata is a specific remedy for senile emphysema. In lobelia, you don't have cough. The predominant symptom is dyspnea. And sometimes, along with emphysema, you have a cor pulmonale. Cor pulmonale means because of the destruction of the lung tissue, the right heart starts failing because the right heart is connected to the lung by the pulmonary artery. Because of the pressure changes, the lung is destroyed anatomically, pathologically, and so is the right heart. And in such a situation, cough is a secondary symptom. You may or you may not get cough, but definitely you keep on getting breathlessness. And lobelia needs to be given for a long, particularly long time. We do start patients, and we have got patients who have been taking lobelia since months together and are better, relieved.
And people might want to know, I believe lobelia is in the tobacco family.
Sorry, I could not get you. What?
Isn't lobelia in the tobacco family of plants?
Yeah. Lobelia is belongs to the tobacco family. And tobacco is one of the reasons the emphysema is caused.
Absolutely. Yep.
Then another wonderful remedy is bromium. A lesser used remedy in India, but nonetheless a very, very good remedy for dry spasmodic cough. But when this emphysematous patient complains of this dry spasmodic cough, he also complains of change in voice, and that voice is hoarseness. And the hoarseness of voice remains hoarse over a period of time. And when the patient starts coughing, there's an intense burning pain behind the sternum. It's not in the throat, it is in the sternum. The patient says that the cough originates in the sternum. And he says, "Doc, actually I can feel that the cough comes out from the lungs. It is not from the throat." And if you put a stethoscope, then you can hear rattles, you can hear rails of mucus, but the mucus is not coming out. So, and the moment the patient is exposed to dry, cold air for an air condition, and if he or she is standing just below the air condition, then he can get cough. Such a scenario, you can give bromium. Bromium also and chlorium, both chlorine and bromium are the remedies for dry spasmodic cough, hoarseness of voice, pain behind burning behind the stomach, sternum, and cold sensation when inspiring. Characteristically, bromium patient, you should ask before giving bromium or chlorine. Suppose you live in the plains and you go to the seaside. What is the change in the cough or symptomatology? He says, "Moment I go to the seaside, I'm better." So better by sea, then characteristic drug is bromium. It's a wonderful remedy. Very few remedies can surpass this when the patient characteristically says that I am better at sea. Moment I go over in a humid climate, seaside, eventually these people do land up having the permanent residences near the seaside, near the shores. Because emphysema is a long-term disease. The disease goes only by the death. So they prefer to change the residences from the mountains or from the plains to seaside.
They say in the books that this is for sailors. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. They are for sailors. Another remedy which can be given over a long period of time is carbovig, wherein you got spasmodic cough and a gagging sensation, or again suffocating sensation, but the patient vomits out blood. There's a slight cough. The cough is only one, single, and you get loads of mucus. And the mucus can be thick and balls. And you can have, after expectoration of mucus, you have burning in the chest. And the bout of the cough, a single bout of cough, is so violent that slight cyanosis, a slight bluish discoloration can be seen on the lips or on the face, just while coughing. After that, the moment the cough stops, the pain subsides. So the cough is so irritating to the patient that in this situation, you should give carbovig. And of course, the typical symptom of carbovig is must be fanned. Patient wants fanning. And last drug I would like to discuss is sulfur. You have got difficult respiration. The sulfur patient would want, wherever one goes inside the house, or in the office would want to keep the windows open. The cuff is loose, generally in the morning, and as the day advances, the looseness keeps on decreasing and you can have dry cuff. In emphysematous patients, if there is pleuritic affections, when pleura are the coverings of the lungs, if you have got mild pleural effusions, then sulfur is your remedy. So these are three-mark symptoms or three-mark remedies we have distinguished. Of course, they need to be given or repeated over a period of time. They need to be stopped for some time and repeated in higher potencies so that patient, because emphysema, as I told you, can be palliated but cannot be cured. So we reserve the symptoms for, reserve the drugs only for symptomatic phases. And throughout the year, the patient may be off drugs. So this is what we have for emphysema. Of course, I'm not going into classification of emphysema, pan-acinar type, and say, because it does not concern the homeopath. It's purely pathological and it's much more theoretical. Clinically, emphysema needs to be handled, as I have told you.
Wonderful. Just excellent teachings today. And we have quite a few listeners in the chat and maybe some others who are not signed up for the chat. If you have any questions for future shows, please send them in. Dr. Adel, tell us your homeocad.org, is it? Is your website?
Yeah, homeoacad.org.
Okay, so I'll put that in there. For folks who want to contact you, there is a form where people can add questions or comments or get care. And we have just so many things. Homeopathy World Community provides education and awareness about this wonderful form of medicine. I know it's late for you and you have to head home. I'm going to just continue for another hour teaching about the principles and art of cure by Dr. Herbert A. Roberts, MD, and we've been reading the number of chapters about the vital force. We're going to continue with that. So I want to thank you so, so much. It's always just a joy to have you.
Yeah, and again, wishing you all the best in your life. Wish you a wonderful birthday ahead, and may God bless you. God bless everyone. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And just hang in there, everyone else, if you want to continue to listen to more about homeopathy today. Okay, so Helen, you're still on the line. You know that folks who are listening to the show, it is really not necessary to call in order to listen. You go to the website and it's Blog Talk Radio, Homeopathy World Community. You click on the show that's live at the time and go ahead and, she's off now. She can, basically you just click the listen on air and then there's a Skype button, the little blue button if you'd like to call in to talk with me. And there's also a call-in number, 347-945-6956 if you're in the United States and would like to call in and talk with me. I'm here, and I'm going to put on a little bit of an exit music for a breather if you want to get a drink of water, and I'll be back talking about the principles and cure with Dr. Roberts, Herbert Roberts, and he's fascinating, way ahead of his time. So here we go.
Thank you for listening to Heart Health and Homeopathy on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and Dr. Adel Chimthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We encourage you to follow our show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when the show airs, and share with friends on Facebook and Twitter. Please send in your comments and questions, and we'll see you next time.
Okay, we are back. We are back. We're going to, last week, chapter 3, we talked about the vital force. And these were some of the questions that he ended up this chapter. He said, to what did Hahnemann attribute the harmonious functioning of the human organism? And so you can read that and find out, or listen to last week's show. I think that was on Thursday. I did it after Alan Phillips, Vaccinations and Your Rights. That was at noon. So if you listen to his show, the second hour, you're going to find the answers to these questions. What is the human unit of human life? What do we mean by the trinity of the individual? And I did post a little something on Facebook, Homeopathy World Community, about the different three aspects of the trinity. And then we have cite some conditions that may cause disturbance of the vital force with consequence disturbed development of the whole economy. What is the outward reflection of the inward turmoil? Why do we look on disease as a dynamic expression rather than as a local matter? So this is really homeopathy. It is the energy of the vital force. Why do we speak about the dynamic force of remedies? And what is sickness? He answers this question, the disturbance of the harmonious functions. He asks, why are remedies potentized? And what is the effect of suppressive treatment in disease conditions? So what he does is he provides for us his lecture, his talk, and then at the end he asks these questions to see if you've been listening, which is really a great way to study and reflect upon what he's said. Chapter 4, we're going to be talking about vital force as expressed in functions, in health, in disease, in recovery, in cure. He says, the life and composition of cells is of a complex nature. The composition of animal protoplasm is capable of analysis, yet there is in each cell and its life function that which is beyond our comprehension and defies analysis. We cannot as yet fathom the reason why a human ovum takes on growth and development only when the spermatozoa embeds itself deep in its innermost nuclei. We only know that it possesses some hidden vital function that compels it to develop and grow. I wonder what he would say today, and Dr. Adel, I see that you're still with us. I wonder what he would say.
Indeed, I am there.
I wonder what he would say about the fact that we now do this in the Petri dish. What would he think about that? The power of each life to develop from the single ovum into its own ego, unfolding and expressing itself forever in its own way and individuality, never varying from the ideal that is once stamped. To carry out to its perfection all the powers of adult life, distinguishing it from all other created species, is a marvel until we comprehend the principle of the vital force or energy permeating all created things. And so he was talking last week about the vital force and that each of us, and I put this again on Facebook, each of us is like a snowflake. We are one individual, our ego, our soul energy, our spirit energy. This is only unique unto each of us, and that's why we are here planted on Earth to carry out some mission. And I think our journey in life is to figure out what is that mission? What are we supposed to be doing here? Do you have an answer?
Well, that answer is to be found. I mean, that's the purpose of life, I believe.
Well, yes.
If one finds an answer, then it's completely with nature. So, and that's the purpose of life. Why are we born? What is the aim of a life? That needs to be thought over, and that needs to be carried over. And aphorism number 9, Hahnemann clearly says that the reason gifted mind, the last line of the aphorism says, so that the reason gifted mind can freely employ this healthy vital force for higher purposes of existence. And what he means by higher purpose of existence is finding the purpose of life. So if your vital force is healthy, then only the reason gifted mind can go on ahead with this finding its purpose in life.
We are all seekers. So Dr. Herbert Roberts continues, that power, although defying analysis, that's within each cell, nevertheless continues all through life as a mysterious manifestation of the vital functions. It is the close study of these vital functions that becomes the chief study of the physician. In order to obtain a thorough knowledge of these vital functions, we must study them in their manifestations during health. From the earliest period of its existence, growth is manifest from within the cell out. It is never observed growing from within, from without in. The one point most vital to observe is the course and direction of its expression, always from within outward. This is true in the embryonic state and is always maintained as long as life exists. This is equally true in the specialization of functions. Especially the organs are developed and their functions maintained by the expression of the vital energy as the life-giving principle. All expression of the mind are such manifestations. Indeed, it is the expression of the vital force in and through the mind and intellect that has a very great influence in the functioning of all life and of the special organs. And that is a very complex philosophy understanding. It's, in a way, if I were to simplify what he said, I might say something that is potent and powerful out there today. What we think is who we are. Would you say that is what he's saying in a way? And you can ask yourself that question. So that he is saying everything grows and functions from within outwardly, starting from the birth, the conception, on the vital force and ego that is implanted within this unification of the egg and the sperm to create this new being. And then that is, it is the foundation for everything else that the human being does and develops in their lifetime. In health, all expressions of vital force may be expressed by perfect functioning of all parts of the body and by a sense of general well-being. And I'll repeat that one. In health, all expressions of vital force may be expressed by perfect functioning of all parts of the body and by a sense of general well-being. Thus, if you are healthy, then you feel good. In disease, this expression is vastly changed. There is a sense of discomfort. The mental expressions are vastly altered according to the degree of disturbance. Physical signs and symptoms appear, and all because the vital functions are disturbed, either from the external impressions having a depressing effect and the consequent reaction of the vital force, or from some hidden miasm coming into its full expression in its impress on the vital force. External impressions having a profound effect upon the vital force are such circumstances as the shock of sudden news, either bad news or joyful news, or severe fright, such as the shell shock we see with our soldiers, long mental and physical strains, and various other reactions. And if you missed the beginning of the show, Dr. Otto spoke about the pathology and the seizures, epileptic seizures, that was a consequence of the motion of jealousy. So we can be discomforted and in ill health based upon how we feel, what we think. Dr. Herbert Roberts says all of these external forces, when in conjunction with an already disturbed vital force, have very profound effects upon the vital functions, and they are manifested in a trail of symptoms which are expressed in different ways in varying individuals. So if you were voting for a particular presidential candidate and your candidate either won or lost, you might have great joy or receive bad news. In other words, after the election, you might not feel so great. Either you might feel really, really great, or maybe you're now tending toward ill health or out of balance, or what he said, the expression of the vital force, may not be in perfect function. Dr. Herbert Roberts says, likewise, the vital function in its manifestations often shows the effect of inherited miasms and disgraces, where the protozoan has become vitiated by disease processes in the antecedents and its perfect form, and possibilities of development are thereby impaired. So that's a lot of words that basically says we have inherited propensities, inherited potential for disease, and when the protozoan, he says, when the cell becomes changed through these disease processes, that is the inherited miasm, that there is an impairment of perfect development toward what Dr. Adel said was our mission, carrying out our highest mission, because we have these obstacles, these disease impairment to our organism. The process of development may go on until such time as some disturbing element, as excessive joy, fright, or anger, or some of the zymotic diseases, come in contact with the disturbed vital energy. When it bursts forth into volcanic action and we see the manifestations of what we call acute disease. So he's saying these different aspects of life come together, the disturbed vital force, that we can still live and we can still breathe and walk and cook and eat and do all of our regular day-to-day practices, but we are slowly moving toward an acute illness, an acute disease that's going to burst forth, he says, has a volcanic action, which is very disrupting. It just bubbles forth, and you think about how he is using this metaphor. He says, sometimes this comes as the first outward and visible sign of a disturbed vital energy. It is analogous to the disturbance that takes place in waters, ponds, and reservoirs when they suddenly begin to heave, seemingly without cause, and throw up upward their pathogenic formations, becoming exceedingly oily, to spend their efforts on this saprolytic action, and so set in motion a clarifying process. So it is with these manifestations in miasmatic or hereditary conditions. A blooming or explosion of these acute diseases is nature's method of attempting to rid the system of these fundamental miasms that have been long buried. These manifestations offer to the homeopathic physician a unique opportunity to learn of the indicated remedy, because at the close of the acute manifestations, nature cried out most loudly and points the direction most clearly, because at this time, symptoms are produced that are of inestimable value in the selection of the constitutional remedy. These disease states or disturbed states of the vital function present very extensive and exceedingly variable external manifestations, and the homeopathic physician must devote much time to their study. And remember that Dr. Roberts, Herbert Roberts, is teaching homeopaths or would-be homeopaths or physicians. This book is written to motivate, inspire, and teach what to look for, how to become a good doctor. And so he's saying the expressions of this acute disease are so important for us to take note of and understand what it is the inner dwelling vital energy is trying to tell us when it bubbles up and bursts forth like a volcanic action, to really throw out and clarify, not only clearing the disease from the body, but clarifying outwardly to an observant physician what remedy would be the best to assist the body in the clarifying process? And with this, I encourage you to listen to the last Health In show that was with Kate Birch and Ms. Scylla Watcott about using homeoprophylaxis and the fact that having fevers, suppressing fevers, these are signs that the body is functioning properly to clear out foreign matter or a hereditary miasm or a disease or a weakness in an organism, in the organ that we as individuals have our own method to show symptoms. And these are really, really important to note and use for healing. The vital force is always attempting to recover from diseased states. And that is what he is saying now. And folks, I know that there are some people who are still listening. I don't always get a chance to check in on you on the chat. But if you do have a comment or want to call in, let me know and I'll try and be there for you. The vital force is always attempting to recover from diseased states, he says. You know, it's like kind of making adjustments all the time to keep your balance when you're walking or riding a bicycle. The body is constantly doing that innately. We don't notice it, these things that, you know, we have cancer cells running through our body all the time, and our body has a way of keeping that in check with the white blood cells carrying it away and cleaning out dead matter and doing all of those functions that are perfectly normal and healthy. So he says in the acute manifestations, the vital functions are often restored to complete harmony by and through their own power. And it is noteworthy to observe the disappearance of symptoms in the reverse order of their appearance. Dr. Odell had just mentioned this in the last talk about Herring's Law, from present day to reverse order, from preserving the most vital organs of the brain, the heart, the lungs, the liver, and moving that disease out, pushing it out into a skin rash or a fever. So we must observe these symptoms going away in the reverse order that they appeared. This is well illustrated by the course of the appearance of symptoms in such manifestations as eruptive fevers. The rash appearing last is the first symptom to appear. It is last to disappear. So if you've got that rash with that fever, he says if it is the last thing to appear, it's going to be the last thing to disappear if it was the first thing to appear. This order is always maintained in invasion and recession of symptoms when the vital force is able to establish complete restoration of normal vital functions. So don't try to suppress the rash, is really what he's saying. The body is taking care of itself. It knows how to function. It knows the order of cure. Acute diseases may take on various forms. The assault may be so great as to destroy life in a short term. The vital force may be so overcome as to be unable to strive successfully against the combination of outward and inward assaults and be completely destroyed. Yes, he's saying that death may occur if the body is not able to handle it on its own, if the assault is so great. On the other hand, it may be able to overcome the disease conditions without outside help, simply by crisis. But when this happens, there is such a drain on the vital energy that it is a decided injury to the life-giving forces. Because of the sacrifice of fluids, when crisis takes place, there is a lowering of the physical powers of the patient. And here again, his very life is in danger. So we can give an example such as influenza. If you have, or malaria, if you have such a disease that you are losing your vital forces, your energy, your fluids by vomiting or diarrhea or sweating or whatever blood loss, whatever it is that you're losing your life energy and you become so drained, then you're in a weakened state, even though your body has survived the assault. What does he say next? He says, when the vital force is not of itself able to make a complete recovery, either due to a hidden miasm or an especially violent assault on the vital energy, the vital force often resorts to methods of bringing about a partial recovery. Thus, the vital force pushes the invader out en masse by taking the inner trenches of the citadel and pushing the enemy to the outskirts of the country by establishing a semi-chronic skin manifestation. He really talks in terms of military battle, doesn't he? Or there may be establishment of a catarrhal disturbance on some one or more of the mucous surfaces, or the establishment of pus abscesses with the expectation and hope of throwing out the enemy. Unfortunately, the emptying of such abscesses may be into an organ or organs where complete expulsion from the body is not possible, as in pyrothorax or pustular appendices. So he's saying the body, the vital force, our innate spirit, is doing everything it can to save and keep survival, and does that by pushing this invader or the foreign attack, whether it is a viral or bacterial, fungus, whatever it is, into a semi-chronic condition, whether we will see it as eczema or psoriasis, whether we will see it as he says, emphysema or bronchitis, something that is constant or chronic like asthma, or even as some sort of an abscess. He goes on to say, remedies will assist in these acute diseases and very, very often save the sacrifice of the crisis and thereby the loss of physical power. It will always remain unknown how this power works in conjunction with the homeopathic remedy to assist in conquering the assaults of the vital force, but that it does so and lowers very markedly the mortality rate in the acute diseases we know to be true. And we can see this historically in the influenzas of 1817. In the past history, we know that the number of people who survived crisis of influenza is much greater than with allopathy and the use of suppressive drugs like aspirin, where many losses occurred. In acute diseases, only is it ever possible for the vital force to rectify the conditions without assistance. So let me repeat that. He says, when there is an acute disease, then the vital force is able to get back into balance, get back into health without the assistance of homeopathic remedies. However, in chronic conditions, this can never be done. This is Dr. Herbert Roberts' statement. This can never be done. The homeopathic remedy assists in the cure because it represents a superior force. No cure can take place unless a superior force is exhibited. The most potent force in the world of medicine is the potentized remedy, more potent by far than is the diseased condition. I hope that you're listening. I hope you understand. I hope it makes sense and people understand why learning, practicing, studying homeopathy is so important. He is basically saying, sure, you can get over a common cold. You can get over something that assaults the body, even if it is something like a infectious, contagious disease. If you have the strength in your vital force to overcome the assault swiftly and without deleterious effects. However, if it becomes chronic disease because the body is trying to survive and was not able to complete a cure, then you have a chronic lingering condition with a weakened organs, a weakened vital force, and the homeopathic remedy is a necessity. He says, under a cure, the symptoms of a deranged vital function always disappear in reverse order of their appearance. This is true in acute as well as chronic disturbances. Because, let me see if I missed anything. Okay, remedies will assist in these acute diseases and very, very often save the sacrifice of the crisis and thereby the loss of physical power. It will always remain unknown, and I did repeat that again, how this power works in conjunction with the homeopathic remedy. The homeopathic remedy assists in the cure because it represents that superior force. Under a cure, the symptoms of a deranged vital function always disappear in reverse order of their appearance. That's Herring's law again. This is true in acute as well as chronic disturbances because this order is always maintained. It is a vital point of observation. So we note that. In very serious cases, when we are so anxious to know what improvement is taking place, we can be assured by watching the order of the disappearance of the symptoms. In this way, we can learn the action of the remedy in its assistance to the vital force and can give an accurate prognosis. This is equally true in acute or chronic states. Basically, we're seeing the progress of disease. We're seeing the progress of the disease as it takes place in front of our eyes, as the person feels queasy, feels not right, you know, you get that sick feeling, and then all of a sudden maybe you start to have a fever or start sweating or end up going to the bathroom. So you measure and document the order of the disease, and to see and note whether you're progressing properly, you will see that the last of the symptoms is going to be the first of the symptoms to go away, and as if you see the breaking of a fever, you know, the fever was the last thing to come, and now the fever breaks and now everything else starts to get better, as an example. Too much stress cannot be laid upon the importance of the law of direction of cure of disease states. Every physician should have this thoroughly ingrained into his consciousness. By cure, we mean the complete eradication of disease states and consequently the complete eradication of the symptoms and a return to a condition of normal, vigorous health. So when the body is weakened, let's say by an acute disease, and just ends up with asthma, has the disease been completely cured? I would say no, because now we're left in a weakened state. Either one or more organs of the body is not functioning properly. Even though you might say get back to work or go back to school after the cold or the flu, you're still not completely well. The vital force must first be set in order by the indicated remedy, and the understanding of this great law of cure has proven of inestimable value in this process, in that we can know definitely whether we are proceeding in the manner that will lead to ultimate cure of the patient, or whether we are merely palliating or suppressing conditions. Dr. Adel, in the last hour, mentioned allopathy is basically palliation or suppression of the conditions. When you give antihistamines and antidepressants and anticoagulants, all of these processes of anti-against are telling the body you don't know innately how to cure yourself, and we are going to just stop that process in its tracks, and then you're going to feel better just because you don't have that symptom anymore. So it is not really cure. The drugs are palliation. Improvement and cure come from within outward, and this he stated earlier. Just as no growth or development can take place from outside inward, so no hope of cure can be held that moves in a contrary direction. Growth and development and cure are centrifugal and never centripetal. So you can imagine he's talking physics here. Movement is that spiral, centrifugal from the inside out. It's the Fibonacci series. It is what you see out there in the stars, in the all of the environment, in plant life, everywhere you see this spiraling outward movement. Symptoms disappear from above downward, Complaints go from an important organ to a less important organ. Symptoms disappear in the reverse order of their appearance. This is what we term Herring's Law and what Dr. Roberts has just given us. One of the best illustrations is the rheumatic fever manifestation. This is a case where the joints of the extremities are first attacked, next the joints nearer the body, and presently we find the heart involved. This is the natural order of the onset of the symptoms. Now, if we relieve the symptoms appearing in the extremities, are we approaching a cure? Consider the vital organs that are in danger, if they are not already attacked. But under the exhibition of the carefully selected homeopathic remedy, the more important organs are the first to be freed, being the last organs to be attacked. And gradually the manifestations recede to the extremities, the first to be attacked. So he is saying here that we must take care of the heart first before we take care of the extremities. I believe that's what he's saying. Let's read on further. It is absolutely necessary that these axioms be thoroughly grounded in our minds. Then it is a pleasure to feel the security that develops from our sure knowledge in the progress of any given case. This pertains also to the artificial disease condition that we get from the drug proving. And so, folks, if you haven't been listening, drug provings are like clinical trials, homeopaths, take or provide a given drug or homeopathic remedy, medicine, to a healthy person, and then that healthy person documents the symptoms that are elicited during a drug proving, and that is called the artificial disease. The onslaught of these symptoms is the same as in natural disease. They come on from below and move upward, or appear first in a superficial organ, and then later move to a deeper organ. When a proving is wearing off, the symptoms recede in the reverse order, just as natural disease symptoms recede. This once more shows the relationship between the natural disease symptoms arising from a disturbed vital energy and the artificial disease symptoms as produced by a drug. This explains also the reason why the potentized drug is so effective in disease conditions. The action of the remedy must follow the same cycle of action under the same laws as the natural action of the disturbed vital energy. So homeopathy works with natural laws, with the natural disease, with the individual as we see the progress of symptoms of this disease. And we see that both in the clinical trials, in the proving, drug provings, and is in the natural disease. And so we know that we're working together. In chronic conditions, this law is just as sure as in acute conditions. But in chronic conditions, we are often faced with a seeming confusion. We have carefully taken the symptoms as reported by the patient and have made our prescription. After a certain progress, the patient comes to us with a new set of symptoms. Careful reference to the symptomatology show no apparent relation to the present symptom picture. Are we progressing in the right direction? Is this a new condition that has arisen? Let us proceed carefully. By cautious questioning, we shall probably find that this is a return of old symptoms in the reverse order of appearance, and that it has been long covered up and forgotten because of the later unfolding symptoms. Then, as the later symptoms have disappeared, this older group has again come to the surface. Now we may know that we are proceeding in the proper direction. Right here, great care must be taken not to mix up the case. If the remedy is doing this work, let it proceed without interference, and the patient will lose these symptoms, and a still order, more deeply buried group will presently come to the surface. And very, very often, you will hear homeopaths talk about layers, that this layer is coming out or we've cleared this layer. And I think that this is very similar to what Dr. Roberts is speaking about here, that it is this is the art of homeopathy, knowing when to give a remedy, when to move up to a higher potency, when to reevaluate and the symptoms have changed and now do we change to a new remedy at this time? Do we use the triads that he mentioned from Nash? One remedy follows another to clear out the different aspects of a disease. These are all the art and cure of homeopathy. So he's saying, be very, very careful, because this one remedy over a long period of time may be uncovering long lost and forgotten symptoms that a person had when they were younger, and there's still cure and progress going on with the initial choice of remedy if it was well chosen. The necessity of constant study of the philosophy that underlies homeopathy becomes more and more apparent if we would be masters of our work and not only study, but a certain degree of patience to wait the course of events. One of the hardest things for homeopaths to do, because we want to see progress, we want to see improvement, and if we don't see improvement, we think we have not made a correct drug choice. But if there is any tiny little improvement, he is saying, hold on, we still may be tending toward direction of cure. He says, however, if we can know that we are proceeding in the right direction, it gives us the patience and the courage to wait through these events, knowing that the prognosis is favorable and our work is effective. And thus he teaches us today in this chapter, vital force as expressed in functions, in health and disease, in recovery and in cure, that we have this ability within ourselves innately to cure many acute diseases, but that when it becomes chronic, we must use a potentized homeopathic remedy. Plus, take note and observe the direction of cure. What he gave earlier in capital letters, symptoms disappear from above downward, complaints go from an important organ to a lesser important organ, symptoms disappear in the reverse order of their appearance. He has just about finished this one chapter, and at the end, he always asks us questions to check whether we have been listening and absorb this information into our psyche. He asks, to what do we attribute the growth and the development of the individual? So he says, we have within us, when the cell is just first formed, the ego, its own life, its own vital force. What is the direction of growth? That is a good question. What is the direction of growth? And then he says, what is health? And what is disease? Go back and listen and see if you have an answer. What do we mean by miasms or discrasias? I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce this. Discrasia, I think it is called. Discrasia. D-Y-S-C-R-A-S-I-A-S. Miasms. And what is their effect on the development of the individual? Well, obviously, he told us about that volcanic eruption coming out, possibly due to inherited potencies, inherited miasms, the possibility of a weakness. How do we regard acute diseases? Well, if you can acutely recover on your own, great. And you may have that power if you have a strong vital force and a good heredity. But if you find that you are in a weakened state after an acute disease, then you need constitutional care. What conditions do we speak of as self-curative? How do we regard such conditions as semi-chronic or chronic skin manifestations, discharges, and the like? What is the order of cure? In taking a case, why do we consider the sequence of symptoms in their onset to be an important point? These are the questions which Dr. Herbert A. Roberts, MD, poses to us after reading Chapter 4 of The Principles and Art of Cure by Homeopathy. I want to thank Dr. Roberts for providing us this information so that we can learn from him and continue to expand our knowledge and improve our homeopathic case-taking and practice. I want to thank Dr. Otto for being with us each Wednesday. And he comes now in the U.S. at an earlier hour. Instead of 11:30, we're starting Eastern Standard Time. We turn the clock back, so it's 10:30 in the morning for us in America. It remains at 9 p.m. in New Delhi, and I usually put up a world clock to check where you are on the planet that you can tune in, and we have tons of archival shows to listen to. Just go to Homeopathy World Community. Along the right-hand column, you're going to find bunches of resources. If you missed Kate Birch, she has written the book, The Solution, Homeoprophylaxis, the Vaccine Alternative. And this means that, folks, if you're giving your kids 60 vaccinations in their young childhood, you are possibly causing deep chronic conditions. What are your alternatives? Take a look at The Solution, her book, and put in the little code HWC that you found and heard about it here. And we also did a complete show with her. So check the Health In group archives for that show. Miranda Castro, internationally known homeopath, provides a special discount on her cell salts and her remedies. So take a look at that. We have the Health In live video archives from our Monday show. Please check out, we're upcoming on Monday. That will be, if I look at my calendar, November 12th at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We're going to talk about recovery from hurricane. And there are many, many things going on, whether it is gas leaks, asphyxia, fungus and infection due to the wet humidity, molds, whether it is flooding, or whether you have a weakened state from diarrhea from the contaminated waterways. What can homeopathy provide to help in these acute conditions from world natural disasters? We have also Homeopathy World Kits and Remedies from Mary Aspinwall, and she has complete kits. You might want to check those out. We have Complete Dynamics, the homeopathic computer program. That's the one that I use. I really love it for research, studying Materia Medica, looking up rubrics, and as a professional homeopath, chiropractor, acupuncturist, MD, if you want to study and utilize this program, there is a link to purchase it. We have Homeopathy for Farm and Garden, Organic Natural Plant and Soil Remedies by Kaviraj. He is a world-renowned expert in plant diseases, whether you want to plant a home garden or you have a huge crop and you are a regular gardener providing for your community. We also have Dr. Deepak Sharma as my co-host on the Health In show, and he has a clinic, Homeopathy on Web. We encourage you to ask your questions of him and visit him. Also, Dr. Otto at homeocad.org. And we have one more. We have Dr. Chambreau. So not only can you take care of your family members, your friends in acute situations and learn about homeopathy, also your pets. And she did a complete series, I don't know what, it might have been 22 shows with me on Blog Talk Radio. Just click her beautiful face wearing her sun hat, and you will be linked to listen to all of her shows about how to take care of your pets and do a journal. Alan Phillips is going to be with us. He has reached out, leading expert in legal issues, exemptions, and waivers about vaccinations today in our world. his show gets at least 1,000 listeners every show. So tune in. That's going to be tomorrow at noon Eastern Time. Kavitha Kukunor, who did ask a question today, has written an inspirational book about her journey as a physician and homeopath in India, coming to America and starting fresh. I'm sure you will love that. She has lots of motivational quotes. And one more, Grant Bentley, who does facial analysis and has been traveling around the globe teaching people how to use this method and learning about the miasms of homeopathy. I hope you've enjoyed our show today. It has been a joy and a pleasure, and working with and just talking to folks, knowing that these shows are purely free, open to anybody to listen, creating waves of awareness, simply educational. If you have a personal question, condition about your health, you must see your health care provider. We are not giving any prescriptions or diagnosing disease on these shows. We are simply teaching and reading and learning together. So until the next time, I will see you on tomorrow, Thursday, November 8th at noon with Alan Phillips. We've got lots of contemporary current events about vaccinations and your rights. Take care, everyone. I love it when you share our shows. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and special guests. We encourage you to follow our show, favorite the show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when shows air, share with your friends on Facebook and Twitter, send in your comments and questions. See you the next time.
I'm not sure.